We've been learning together about columns because the way this has proceeded so far, for some of you who are new, is that I make very sparse introductory remarks, and then we begin to talk together about how the poem that we're looking at works. One of the disclaimers that I have made the last two times and will make again is that the title suggests that there's some kind of special technique or special, the title of the session, Nature Poems and How to Read Them, or Nature Poetry and How to Read It, suggests that there's some kind of special skills or some kind of special package of insights that a person needs in order to read nature poetry as opposed to other kinds of poetry, and this is false. I chose nature poetry only in the very loosest sense of nature poetry, that is, poetry that has as a part of its, there's some extra copies over there and here, and if people come in while we're working, one of you could point those out to people. I appreciate it. At any rate, I was saying that nature poetry in the loosest sense of the word, in that the poems are set in natural surroundings or refer in large part to things of the natural world and so on. So the aim here is not somehow to claim or to suggest that there is some special quality to nature poetry that means we read it in some strangely different way than we would read poetry of another sort, which had a different subject matter or different tone, whatever. We have had some success by beginning with a certain kind of question on our two previous poems, even though they were very different kinds of poems. We first did, on Monday, The Road Not Taken, another poem by Broth, and we began by taking in the whole thing, sort of assessing it quietly, and there are silences here which are good to have, give people a chance to think before they respond or offer some comments. And we noticed after a while that the Road Not Taken seemed to be really two separate stories. So we broke the poem up into two parts. And then once we had done that, distinguished the first story from the second story, we began to notice things on in each of those two parts of the poem and compare them and contrast them, and that kind of got us deeper and deeper into what the poem was doing. So in a large part, we started by talking about the movement from the beginning of the poem to the end, and to give a kind of description. And the description we gave was, this poem consists of two stories. And what moves us from the first through the fourth stanza is the momentum of those two stories. Then we did Two Autumns, a poem by John Keats. And there, the movement was not at all an instance of narrative or story, a kind of movement through time, but it seemed to be a kind of elaborate invocation and characterization of the season autumn. And the three stanzas each complicated the picture that the one before put forward. So they were kind of different aspects of autumn that were set over and against one another, which gave one a deeper sense of a certain profound sentiment about not only the nature of that season, but the nature of the speaker's sense of the natural world. Today we have a very short lyric, undoubtedly the most famous lyric Frost ever wrote. As I told people the first time, poets are themselves notoriously unhelpful when it comes to explaining their own poetry. That is, lots of them don't like to talk about it. The poem says what they want to say, and to say something about the poem is then somehow corrupted as far as they're concerned. If they had wanted to say what they had to say some other way, they'd have done it. But they wrote a poem, and so to talk now about the poem makes them feel uncomfortable, and that's sensible enough. Frost is kind of impish and likes to, when people ask him questions about his poetry, when they did, he used to come up with off-the-cuff explanations that many people would run home and write about and think this was the key to the poem. And one of his more favorite statements about this poem was that he wanted to see, it was so tough to maintain this kind of rhyme scheme, very difficult rhyme scheme, that he just set himself up the question, can I come up with four stanzas such that each one of them has three words that rhyme, and in the second last line, a new rhyme is introduced, which becomes then the dominant rhyme of the next stanza, this kind of interweaving. So that he set up himself, so for example, if you look at the first stanza, no, though, and snow rhyme, here picks up the major rhyme of what the next stanza, queer, near, year. Lake is the second last, that picks up shake, mistake, etc. So Frost's explanation for this lovely lyric was that he set himself a very difficult and almost impossible technical problem. And if you don't believe that it's an extraordinary technical problem, try some time writing a poem in this kind of rhyme scheme. It's with this kind of simple, direct, accessible diction, that is, that kind of simple word choice, and see how far you can get. I never get very far myself. So anyway, we can't turn to Frost, and we can't even identify this voice with the voice of Robert Frost the person. Instead, he's created a kind of character, a speaker who's speaking to us. Okay? That's part of the creation of the poem, the sense that we get of this speaker. Okay, I've said more than I normally do by way of introduction, but let's do begin with kind of the same question. As you reflect on this poem, what do you think would be a way of accounting for or giving a short description of the kind of movement in it from the first through the fourth stanzas? All right, let me put it a little more crisply. Of the last two poems, we had one that was, the movement was narrative, story, and another that was, movement was topical, three aspects of autumn taken up one after the other. Would you say that this would fall more into the topical or more into the narrative kind of?
Narrative.
Pardon?
Narrative.
A narrative. You think that we have principally a story here. Would the rest of you see that too? That this is principally a story?
I think it's more reflective.
It's contemplative.
Yes.
Okay. It's a contemplative poem. Would it necessarily be have to be contemplation or meditative gets us into the kind of tone, the whether the poem is serious or light, whatnot, and this is to say that it's kind of meditative, but could it be both meditative and story? I mean, would it have to be one or the other?
No, of course it
wouldn't. Okay, so would you accept, do you think that, I think you seconded the notion contemplative, didn't you, back there?
Yes.
Would you be receptive to the notion that it was a contemplative narrative?
It's a very brief narrative.
Okay, sure. Okay, let's suppose for a moment, just to start out, that it's a contemplative brief narrative. Okay? Very short story moves through the... Well, what's it a story about then? What's it a short contemplative story about?
I'm not sure I agree that it's a narrative, in the sense that it's an experience. And nothing really happens except the poet or the writer experiences something, a kind of poetic experience, and then moves on. I'm not sure anything really in the sense of a narrative event is occurring. There's not really anything happening there except his own sensibilities being compete. So to see.
Okay, so you think it's primarily primarily entails the unfolding of a sensibility, or at least representation in words of a consciousness, psychological experience.
Yes.
Anyone want to respond to that? Let's kind of use narrative, let's play off for a moment narrative over and against the hypothesis that it's a psychological experience and see if we can either come up with something that accommodates both of them or settle more heavily upon either unfolding the psychological experience on one hand or story on the other. Let's just see how the rest of you feel.
It's a single incident, so there's no real progression from one time toward another, but it seems to me that's an ingredient of narrative, at least.
What?
Well, that there it is an incident. He is recounting a happening rather than evoking a more abstract description, he really says a lot more, seems to me, about the details of the event than he does in describing the forest.
Yes.
It's a story about a man riding his horse, and he stops to watch the snow, and then actually for half the film he identifies with the horse, which is interesting, and then he passes on.
He seems to be, he's riding it as if it's happening, like when he's riding down the hill.
That's an interesting thing to notice that it happened in neither of the other. Certainly the last time we had anything like a story, it was in past tense part of it, remember? First narrative of Road Not Taken in past tense, and then that last in this kind of strange future perfect tense. I will be telling this with the song. This is all present tense, which may be one of the reasons that you feel that it's really more of a kind of a experience or psychological description or unfolding of a sensibility than a kind of ongoing story that passes through time from beginning to middle to end, past to present to future. More elaborations on this. And when you can, by all means, as the three of you just did, guide us all to looking at details in the poem to kind of elaborate what your view is here. I just want to hear more on this notion of, is this an unfolding of a sensibility, or is this a story? Or can we come up with some restatement of what the poem does that would accommodate both of those? Okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to propose something that if it doesn't make those people all happy who put forward these ideas, let one of them say so. Let's do this as a kind of test together. Let's pick up on the notion of its being principally either an unfolding of or a revelation of or a representation of a sensibility and experience. Let's go with that. And let's see whether we can salvage some notion of narrative within that broader framework by trying to discover whether, as this speaker goes through the four stanzas, that character or that sensibility changes, and if so, what are the changes? Whether or not, in other words, there's first one kind of feeling, then another succeeded by another, or a kind of deepening of a certain feeling or a complication of a certain feeling. Let's, in other words, see if it's a kind of static revelation of a sensibility, or whether or not the speaker, this consciousness that we're aware of, this sensibility, if you will, undergoes certain changes. Okay? Let's see what happens, in other words, in that framework. That would be a way of salvaging some notion of movement, but maintaining the major characterization of this as a poem that reveals a kind of sensibility or character or experience.
Okay? I think the movement is away from the poetic experience and into a more realistic experience. And the last two lines reflect that the author has an experience, but he is, as so often happens in a lot of prose poems, he's drawn away from it by other factors, namely the world of reality and work and other things that he has to go on to do, has miles to go before he can finish his day, so that he's drawn through the experience and then out of it somehow into more workaday type of experience that he has.
Okay. Fine.
There's movement in the sense that it's a psychologic movement without there being any.
I'd like to suggest that it's a philosophic movement, taking the experience of a moment and turning it into an insight about the nature of life and miles to go before I sleep.
So you think that that whatever precedes the last line is taken up by the last line of the poem as a kind of moral or philosophical point?
I think I'd say it differently. I don't reject what you're saying. The macrocosm of history is caught up in the microcosm of a moment of reflection.
Okay, so that may get back into the contemplative idea that was brought out earlier, that there was a kind of deep thoughtfulness to the philosophical implications of this whole complicated experience that we're presented. Again, I think that doesn't, what that does is to complicate it and enrich, in a certain sense, the notion of this movement of a sensibility or a character, and remind us of the rich philosophical dimensions, which is something we'll want to attend to, what kind of content we can give to that philosophical reflection as we go on. But let's take this gentleman's, I'm sorry, I don't, why don't you just mention your name so that I don't have to refer to this gentleman?
Nick.
Dick, okay.
Nick, with an N.
Pardon?
With an N.
Nick, okay. Why don't we take Nick's notion that, yes, there is a sensibility, yes, there is a movement, but the movement is from, he's given us now a kind of pattern, from a kind of poetic to a kind of realistic experience. That the change in the sensibility of the speaker goes from something like, can you give us some synonyms for what you might mean by poetic experience?
Well, any kind of deep appreciation of a natural event that would go beyond a practical type of experience.
Okay. From a poetic or appreciative...
mesmerized or trance-like.
Okay, trance. Okay.
Insightful.
Yeah, okay. We'll put down reflective, since that's come up in a couple of other connections, and now insightful. From all of these things to what was called realism, or I suppose practical, would that be a practical? Okay. That gives us a basic framework to kind of test, if only in order to reject it or to modify it or something, and forces us into exactly the details of how we know this change takes place, or something like it.
I think it's interesting that he doesn't actually say anything at all about why he wants to watch the woods or how it makes him feel to watch, stop and watch. We're inferring all of these things, that he's really reflecting on it or appreciative of it or having an aesthetic experience.
Yes?
I
think there's certain hypnotic-like experiences we don't have, like watching a fire. You can sit and watch a fire sometimes for hours and it sort of just takes over and enchants you. I think the same thing watching snowfall. You know, just sort of, you just become wrapped by it. And to me, this is sort of what the horse is depicting. And to the course of the horse, it makes no sense because he's not enchanted by this. And so the writer talks about that. And then he snaps back to reality like Nick suggested and poem ends.
Okay. That reminds us of a lot of the details in the poem and gets us into looking at particulars. The horse, what's the horse doing there? Is the horse a separate character in the poem? The hypnotic or trance-like quality, which came up as a word there, and then you restated about looking at a fire, we can get lost in it. Your point about not knowing quite why he stops to begin with, all we've got are the words he uses to tell us about this, and let's see if we can anchor some of these intuitions in particular words or phrases, and attend to the horse and what the horse is doing in this poem, by the by. All as a way of looking at whether we have a movement from those kinds of terms to those kinds of terms in this poem to just as a characteristic of the psyche of the speaker. So let's start in the first stanza, okay? Yeah.
Seems to me that he's self-conscious there. He's thinking about the owner and whether he'll be seen doing this. And in that sense, I'd say he's not lost in the experience.
Okay, that's interesting. The first sentiment we get, the poem begins, whose woods these are, I think, I know. Whose woods these are, I think I know. Whose? So there's first, the first attention in this sensibility is to the owner. Now, what is a person like who, happening upon a scene that we're given in the title, first thinks of who owns it, and then says, I think I know who owns it, or whose woods these are. I mean, what kind of a person is that?
A Vermonter.
Pardon?
A Vermonter.
A Vermonter. That, for me, that's kind of cryptic. In other words, Vermonters in what respect?
Well, frugal Yankee, concerned about the hard questions of financial realities. Things belong to somebody, and you don't intrude on other people's space, privacy.
I see. Okay.
Or maybe he's heard that so-and-so owns this property. You know, it's a kind of aloofness on the part of the Vermonters.
Okay. Okay. Other added, either for the first line of the first stanza, elaborations of the kind of character who would say this kind of thing first?
A worker.
Pardon?
A worker.
It's just what I was going to say. Some of it, maybe it could have been delivering events or
what makes you think that you hear the voice of a worker here? What specifically?
Well, to me, when I read it, I get this feeling that he's going home from maybe having made several deliveries to several places.
So your sense would be, someone else said, here's a person on a horse, your sense is that the horse is pulling the sleigh or something? That he's been delivering something?
Mm-hmm. I'd always assume that somehow.
Well, his harness failed, and out here anyway, we don't put a harness on a horse that we're riding. So we put a harness on a horse that's
Yeah, we just put a bridle on.
Okay, so it would be, he gives his bridle bells a shake if but instead the word harness suggests that the horse is in harness and therefore pulling something, has been, that's now empty or half full or something like that.
Could be a carriage.
Yeah, that's what I always thought. Of course, I saw Oklahoma and that, you know,
that all comes later.
That all comes later, right?
I think still, the first line still gives you a sense of a person who's concerned with hierarchy and people who are on the lower end of the scale are more concerned about. On the upper.
Yeah, but he doesn't think he's going to be seen. As if there's consequences if he is, but he's. I get the feeling he doesn't really give a hang whether the guy sees him or not. I mean, but he's quite confident that he won't be seen, so he won't have to say anything to anybody about it.
I mean, many of those New England towns anyway that often. They might not. Well, if it's like a small European village off in the woods where. Separate from the house, and the house might be in the town. This just may be where the guy gets his firewood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now what's interesting in all these comments is that in the first stanza, which is a huge amount of writing in the context of this poem, right? I mean, first stanza is 25% of the poem. I haven't seen anything yet to suggest. I've heard people talk about unease, transfiction, which kind of ties into the notice of poetic, but there was a kind of class consciousness. This is a worker. People that are workers worry about hierarchies and ownership. So I've heard a lot in the character of this sensibility having to do with class, having to do with fearfulness, apprehension. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here. These woods go up. So I've heard nothing that suggests that there's a kind of poetic moment going on here. If anything, there's been things like uneasiness, class consciousness, and so on.
His reason for stopping in the first place is to watch snowfall in the woods.
So you think it picks up in the last line?
Yeah, that was a poetic thing. He didn't stop there to see how much snow was falling, to measure the snowfall or anything like that. He wanted to see it. He wanted to see it more.
Yeah, I never felt that he was uneasy. I felt that maybe he's a responsible person with respect for other people's property more than that. He's afraid of the other person.
Okay.
But I think everyone has their own feeling. I don't feel mine is more valid.
Well, it may point us to something which is genuinely in the poem, though, and persuade others it's something they overlook. You think it's more a sense of trespass. that's at issue.
No, I think it's sort of a respect for property.
Okay. Well, the first word, whose, seems to be that the person does care about in some way property, right?
Yes.
Okay. Whose woods these are, I think I know. Okay? Would the rest of you agree that prior to the fourth line, the notion of a poetic experience or a sensibility that's fundamentally engaged in a poetic or trance-like moment doesn't come through?
Oh, I think it does. I can feel myself in the position of the writer. As a reader, I feel like I'm there, transformed, and watching the snow come down before me. And it's somebody else's woods, but it's for everybody to enjoy.
But we don't see that until the fourth line.
Yeah.
So the first three, we don't know that he's watching it yet. Until the fourth line.
Yeah. But what difference does that make, though? It all goes together. The four lines. To make a complete statement.
Well, I guess I hear you asking whether there's any sense of the poetic in the first three.
Mm-hmm.
But his reason for stopping, he must have a reason to stop.
It's the beauty of the snow coming
otherwise
down.
Otherwise he's going right on through.
But up the third line, you don't know whether he's stopping because he's tired,
right,
or he wants to get a horse arrest, or he wants to...
Well, I don't judge before I finish.
Okay, look, here's a way to put the implications of the kinds of questions in the first stanza, all right? The first word in the title is stopping. And the first three lines in the first stanza, rather than to talk immediately about why they're stopping, or to talk immediately about the experience of stopping, is to introduce notions that characterize how the speaker feels about stopping. Now he doesn't say explicitly, "I feel funny about stopping," but there's this all these concerns. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He won't see me stopping here. And then we finally learn why to see his woods fill up with snow. So before we get to the why of the stopping, we get details put forward that suggest a kind of feeling about the act of stopping. And we have different notions, respect for property, apprehension, fearfulness of discovery, he won't see me. Can anybody share with us their sense of exactly what that feeling is before we learn the why? Yes.
Doesn't want somebody to think he's foolish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or trespassing.
Well, he's still out on the road.
Doesn't want to intrude.
I go along with foolishness. I think he feels a little, people might think he's a little silly. Standing out there in the woods.
Looks like he's loafing.
Pardon?
Looks like he's loafing.
Okay, guilt. Good. There's another sense. Guilty, foolish. So here is a speaker who not only is worried about who owns the woods, but about what that person would think of him or her if he saw. So this guilt and foolishness. This is a speaker who worries about what other people think, in particular the owner, and who worries about who owns the woods. And there may be guilt involved in this too. Now that's interesting, you see. When we discover that feelings like this, I don't think we have to take a vote on exactly what the feeling is, because we're never going to decide that finally anyway. But when we get words like guilt, apprehension, feeling foolish, being other-directed, caring more about what others think of us than about ourselves, and we have that in the first three lines, then we hardly have yet poetic, appreciative, trance-like, reflective, and insight. Instead, we've got things like apprehensive, guilty, foolish, whatnot. So the first sense of the character we get are things like that, even though we may later find, in subsequent verses, details to support this other business. Yes?
Might it be that the interest in who owns it is more of a way of identifying just where he is than really being concerned about that individual? I think I know where I am, I'm by so-and-so's wood.
Well, I thought that too, almost as if he's giving himself permission, but it's that third line that keeps bothering me.
Yeah, well,
he
that's
will not
all
see me stopping.
I think he just wants to be alone. He wants to have a private experience, and since he knows the owner lives in town and feels he can be here by himself without anybody bothering him. That's what I've always seen.
I see. So he wants to be, what he's doing in the first three lines is assuring himself of his own solitude. Here is the speaker who craves solitude and is assuring himself that he indeed has it in the first three lines.
Well, if you're from a very, very small town, you're aware, you know, no matter how you feel, you're aware that everybody will comment if they see somebody stop at the most doing what they're doing. And maybe that's kind of dangerous. He's more self-conscious about that, which is...
That's back into the kind of other-directed, I wonder what others will think of me, uneasiness, as opposed to, I think the assurance of solitude is a very different kind of speaker than the uneasy one, and we'll have to, I think, really go on before we can see whether we find the speaker getting relieved of unease, more uneasy, which would tend to put us in the uneasy, apprehensive, guilty, foolish ballpark, or reassuring himself of solitude, appreciating solitude as a fact of life, whatever. So let's go now into the next stanza. Okay? We've got these kind of, not quite conflicting, but subtly and importantly different notions of the speaker. And let's see with the second stanza where we go.
The horse sort of supports the uneasiness there. The horse thinking it queer, and in the second line, in the third stanza, asking if there's some mistake. Sound of the bell is almost indicating some mistake. So that, to me, sort of reinforces the uneasiness of the first stanza.
Okay, let's stick within the second one, instead of anticipating things into the third. And you say that the horse thinking it queer seems to support notion of unease. And even perhaps deepen it. The gentleman in the back, I'm sorry, in the yellow shirt, and what's your name?
Floyd.
Floyd brought up the horse before, and I promised we'd come back to it. Floyd, do you think the horse is a separate character in this, if you want to call it psychodrama, to capture both narrative and sensibility, who has a kind of personality of his or her own, or is the horse serving some other function in the fall?
Some other function.
And what do you think that would be?
Well, the man identifies and sort of takes the horse's point of view.
Okay. So in other words, the horse is something for the man to project his own sentiment, or a part of his own sentiment, onto.
Yes.
Or what we would call, if you think he's guilty, Nick, it would be the case of objectifying guilt. You know, I feel guilty, and so I think my father hates me. And there he is. That kind of thing. Yeah, what were you going to say, Roxy?
I was just thinking that, well, the word queer there means that the horse probably thinks I'm crazy. And then I was thinking about that first part again, saying, if the owner of the woods came and saw me just standing here or just looking at this woods filled up with snow, he'd think I was crazy. And then, well, probably my horse thinks I'm crazy too, without their eyes, you know. Yeah.
I think he's almost remarking it with amusement.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
So you're back to the lighter tone. My little horse, if you were giving an oral interpretation, you'd say, oh, my little horse must think it queer to stop at the farmhouse near, instead of...
Yeah.
A little horse must think it queer to stop.
That's great.
It's something he doesn't usually do. The horse usually goes on home. And here he is stopping. And the horse is, as you say, he's projecting something through the horse in a way. He's wondering why he's stopping too, probably.
All right, but what you say puts you then into the sort of semi-whimsical, and yeah, you must think this, but I'm not going to get all deeply feel great angst about this. You don't feel that kind of heaviness there. What? Go ahead.
Not going to worry that much about what my horse thinks of me.
Okay. Well, one could say that. One could say that it's transparently silly for someone to worry that much about what the horse thinks of them. Or one could turn that on its head and go, what kind of a man could be so hung up about what he's doing that he would even attend momentarily to what his horse might think about him?
Well, the horse should have harness.
Pardon?
Horses probably anxious to get back to something that's warm.
Yeah, but I've seen horses do just that. It's almost like they're asking a question. They'll stop at the fork in the trail and shake their head like that, as if to say, well, which way are you going to head me?
Okay, what in fact does the horse, as the horse is imagined, in the world of this poem, why does this horse think it's queer, and since we're already anticipating a third stanza, give his harness bells a shake? We're told why the speaker thinks the horse does this. All right.
There's no purpose for them to do.
Okay.
The horse doesn't understand the watching of the wish fulfilled. The horse doesn't understand that. He can't see any beauty in it.
Okay.
Just getting wet.
It doesn't fit the pattern the horse is used to.
Yeah.
That's what I think. The horse is used to going straight on home. Mm-hmm. And here he stopped him in a strange place.
All right, so it sounds to me that these collection of comments, quickly we've got the horse as being somehow the representation of those things that we put on the far side of the board, like realism and practical and so on, that somehow the horse embodies those notions.
Horse sense.
Fine, good. The horse has horse sense. The horse has horse sense and can't figure why someone would just stop to watch woods fill up with snow. Yeah, everybody seems, we seem to have hit a great consensus here.
Not quite. The possibility occurs to me that this poetic moment is perceived as something beyond the comprehension of the horse, but only the man, made in the image of God, can conceive of what's really happening here.
Okay. The horse is not privy to the kinds of psychological experiences that man by his nature is privy to.
What a wonderful artist man.
Okay. And that gets in some of the stuff you introduced earlier as being somehow of the deepest philosophical and spiritual implications here. What are we going to do, all of us, together, if we take on the one hand the notion that the horse has horse sense and therefore can't be privy to the aesthetic or poetic quality of the experience, but the initial thing we all agreed on, namely that the horse really is an independent functioning character here, who kind of breaks into the drama and says, gee, I think it's kind of weird stuff about a farmhouse in here, but that those words are put into the horse's mind by the same speaker who can appreciate the aesthetic side. Does that mean that the speaker is himself or herself has a kind of horse sense part and has a kind of poetic part, and that instead of the poetic part being at the beginning and a movement toward practical and realistic, that what we get in the second and third stanza is a dramatization of the internal tension within the one psyche or sensibility of the practical pulling against the aesthetic. Okay?
You know, I think that's in the very first stanza, kind of arguing with himself about whether to stop or not.
Okay, so here we have a drama of the soul with itself, or one part of the soul with another part, or if you prefer psyche to soul or sensibility, fine, but you have a sensibility that is divided, and there's a tension, a pulling one way and another, which sets up a tension in the poem. Which side of the soul is going to win out?
In my mind, a feeling of solitude. You know, when he says all this, and the first person you know is all alone, and it's quiet, and it's good.
Okay.
Time to be quiet and collect himself, pull himself together maybe before he goes home.
I think that clearly the sense that he's alone and the sense that he wants to assure himself of solitude, as you pointed out to us quite a while ago, is indisputably there. The question is, how does he feel about the fact that he's alone? Is he unequivocally delighted, and does he unequivocally take relish in this? Or is there another element which makes him feel, another side of him, that makes him feel profoundly uneasy, the side which he projects upon the horse, who thinks it's queer to stop at a farmhouse near and give his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake, etc.
Each stanza really has the drama in it. There's always the practical and the poetic side of each one. Usually it's let off of the practical until the last stanza, and it reverses itself.
All right. The rest of you see what's being said here, that each stanza contains a kind of microcosm. Well, at least each of the first three contain the pull toward the practical and realistic, and also the statement of the aesthetic. Can people help us now find details to support that view in any one of the three stanzas? We did the first one together and saw first three lines were one thing, fourth line another, but let's do the same thing for the second and third so we're all clear about what we mean here.
I think I see a pattern here. When you're saying, it's almost as if the verses are divided and one part is talking about the practical side and the other part is talking about the aesthetic side. So in the first verse, the first three are the practical side and the last one is the aesthetic one. And the middle two, the first two are the practical and the last two are the aesthetic. And then the last one, it's sort of the upside down of the first one. The first one is the aesthetic and the other three are the practical side.
Okay.
Mirror image.
Yeah.
Rest of you accept that? It's nice because notice how all of the reinforcements in the rhyme scheme that I told you about first go with that. I mean, just as the substance of each stanza is interwoven with the next stanza in the sense that each stanza contains this tension, so the rhyme scheme is carried and woven through in the interesting ways that Frost manages to do that and give us that sense of interlocking or mirror-like quality to each stanza. But this gets away then from the notion, it's not quite true. But by virtue of people citing the last stanza placing a heavier weight on the one than the other, and suggesting that the weight may have been reversed in one or all three of the, that is the weight toward the practical is heavier in the last stanza, is what I'm hearing, and the weight toward the aesthetic is heavier in one, if not all three, of the first three. We still have there a dynamic, a movement, a development, but the tension was there from the beginning, okay? Let me ask you this question. As we move into the third stanza, he gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. We now get the only other sounds, the sweep. Picking up on your ideas that there's this tension in each stanza, would you say that the tension has reached a kind of extraordinarily tense equipoise here, as though it's half and half? I mean, to be quite mechanical and quantitative about it, the first two lines, he gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake, is the deepest statement we've got. There's a deep wrong here. We've gone from queerness in the preceding stanza to now a mistake. And from vague apprehension in the first stanza through queerness through, my God, there's something wrong. Okay? And then the last two lines, the only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flight, as though each side is expressed in its fullest powerful, the fullest powerful statement of the two sides is given right here in the third stanza, to make us want to know what in the world is going to happen here. Okay? Let's attend to the diction. Why do you suppose we have words like downy here? Why downy flake?
Softness. What they look like.
We have a lyricism to the aesthetic portion of the poem that's certainly not present in the other ones.
Okay, there's certainly that kind of special lyric quality about these last two lines. The particular word downy again. Someone mentioned softness.
It's not solid. It's kind of something you can't really grab hold of. You know, it's kind of fleeting.
And it's just like, it's not, to me, it gives the indication it's not snowing very hard.
Can you talk just a little bit louder?
We just can't hear you over here.
To me, it's more the indication of downy flake that it's not snowing that hard. It's just very light and soft, maybe.
Actually, the downy flakes are the biggest, like that big, heavy snow.
Mm-hmm. Like
down, which is feather.
Yes?
I like what you said about thinking you can't hold the moment.
Okay. Downy, what does down suggest?
Light.
Feathery.
Not
soft, feathery, and what we normally think of, what context is the most?
Bed.
Bed, right, I think bed, certainly. Bed, obviously pillows and so on, down, feathers, whatnot. The point being here that to wonder whether there's a kind of sleepy quality already introduced and connoted in the word down, which is of course later picked up very forcibly in the last two and most celebrated lines of the poem, Miles to Go Before I. Sleep. I mean, in other words, the fact that the speaker, it would occur to the speaker at this crucial moment to use the word downy flake already gives us a strong intimation that something more than simply the physical beauty of the flakes is at stake. Just what kind of sleep is at stake is also very interesting. Could anyone tell me what literally would happen to the speaker if the speaker would remain forever, I'm sorry, if the speaker would remain here on and on and on and transfixed by the scene? Well, I think it's safe to say that he would eventually freeze to death. He may go to sleep first and then freeze to death. He may therefore enter one kind of sleep which directly resulted in another kind. So I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that these last two lines, seems to me, are going to prepare us for the sleep and drive us into the fourth stanza where we must now find out what in the world, given the tension that's built to this point, is going to happen. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. And if that's the last statement we get before the strongest fulcrum in the poem, but. That word, but, just as we saw in the Road Not Taken, in that last stanza we saw a real fulcrum there where the tense has shifted. Here we have a direct, the woods are lovely, dark, and deep. Then but, okay? Lovely, dark, and deep. Anybody care to expand on that? The three words there and what they connote as much as denote. Yes, what?
That's seductive type language.
Yes, it lures him, mm-hmm. It draws him, okay, to go on deeper.
Seduction, I like that word.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if he did, there would be the danger there that he'd stay too long.
Sir, is there any possibility to the theory that I've heard once that Frost was contemplating suicide here in this last bit?
Well, it may be that the speaker is contemplating suicide, or at least maybe that kind of reading is defensible in terms of some of the details we're presenting. I think, in other words, it's an option, a genuine option for an interpretation of the poem. And the notion of temptation and seduction into death, if in fact that would be what practically happened, if he succumbed on and on, would certainly be a strong supporting detail for that reading.
It would be a different kind of suicide, really, more of an economic type, if he were to succumb to these types of poetic experiences over and over again. One doesn't have to think that he's going to take his own life necessarily, but that practicalities of his life are such that he can't afford to indulge in these kinds of experiences very often.
Okay.
Although if you consider him as making his living being a poet, maybe that's the most practical way you could do it.
But the speaker's not characterized as a poet here.
He's a worker.
If the speaker's characterized as a worker, then Nick's point works here. If he suddenly were to speak of himself as a poet, as lots of poets do, they speak of themselves as poets, the speakers speak of themselves as a poet in the poem. But this speaker is not a poet. So that won't work.
I was wondering on that, though, although there's nothing here to indicate that Frost is identifying himself with the speaker, to me there's nothing to indicate that it is not an experience that he could himself has had as well as anybody else.
Right, there's nothing to indicate that it isn't Frost, but it seems to me that as we put together the characterization, our sense of the speaker, by the way this person talks and the constellation of his own apprehensions, in the first stanza we kind of agree this is the sort of thing that someone who's a worker is concerned about, and the person's vocation in the last stanza, having promises to keep, and the whole notion of a harness and something pulling a wagon and making deliveries and all that, seems to, if not absolutely determine the speaker as a working person, at least add up to a strong case for that.
I don't think a working I don't think a working person would have time to stop off there in the woods.
Or he'd be tired enough that he'd, you know, want to go straight on home.
Yeah.
Everybody has a harness of some kind.
The harness, in other words, that the horse wears is a kind of metaphor for everyone's being harnessed, including the speaker, to something.
Yeah. I don't see any particular.
But we all tend to picture ourselves in this position, kind of like what she's saying, when we read this poem, don't we picture ourselves there, at least I do. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas in other poems, you picture someone else being there. Here you kind of, you know, you're sitting behind the horse and you're experiencing that incredible
location. I want to point out, just in response to your point about a working man wouldn't do this kind of thing.
Normally,
is that this, if you entertain the notion that he is in some sense a working man, it's consistent with that. This working man's very worried about it. This working man doesn't feel altogether good about what he's doing. He thinks maybe there's a mistake, it's queer, and all that. I mean, so that's consistent with characterizing him as a working man. In fact, In a curious kind of way, your intuition that a working man wouldn't do this supports the notion that he is a working man. See, because he feels funny about it. He's stopping there, but not, oh yes, I've got all the time here. But, you know, it's all this, not angst, and at least apprehension. I don't want to browbeat people into believing that it's a working man. You don't. That's fine.
You're going to change your mind.
Fine. Yeah.
Why couldn't it be Frost in his late childhood, adolescent years, possibly as a running errands or something like that, and before he became a poet, so to speak? I don't know his background, but maybe he was a poet. He probably was in his early years.
He certainly lived a very rural life. He dropped out a couple of schools, worked on a farm, wrote poetry, and so on. So. And the substance and texture of his poems are taken from that, but we simply have no evidence, certainly in this text that we're looking at, that this is an autobiographical statement. Though it may be. I mean, it's not to say that it is, it's not to say that it isn't.
I think Persian's best works generally are from his own experiences, and I think Frost really did experience this.
He may have. There's no way we can know for sure.
Well, I would still think that the kinds of attitudes that we're talking about are not characteristic just of a working class, but are characteristic of small-town Vermont society. It was a kind of a homogeneous society, as I picture it, from no great knowledge about it. But everybody would feel pretty much that same way, whatever they happen to do for a living.
Okay, I think let's move off the particular profession of the person, because it seems to me that what's important to establish is less whether the person's a working man than that the person doesn't characterize himself or herself in this poem as a poet, which is where we kind of start. But let's not go into the fourth stanza. We've kind of sidled into it in the first line. The but. I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. Question. Why are the last two lines repeated?
It gives you almost a lulling effect. It supports the speech.
I think it alludes to a double meaning.
Okay, and could you unpack that a bit?
Well, is it to go to sleep tonight, or is it to go to sleep indefinitely? You know, is it death he's talking about, or temporary arrest? It's really kind of hard to know, but when he, the woods are lovely, dark and deep. The grave is also dark and deep.
Mm-hmm.
And he might be transposing the woods that way. And I've always kind of wondered about that last verse, you know, what did he really mean by sleep?
Mm-hmm. But your reading of the poem that you're sharing with us now is that the reason it's repeated is very straightforward, that it means something different the second time. That the first time it means it quite in the literal, practical, lyrical setting in which we find the whole poem carried through. And that the repetition lifts that whole experience from a kind of, I've got a lot of obligations before I fall asleep this evening, to I've got much to do before I die.
Right. Yeah.
Yes?
Seems to me that he must want to really intensify the statement in repeating it that way, and I certainly agree that in that he's universalizing the second one and having a different meaning to it, because to me that is a bit disturbing as far as the symmetry of the rhyme scheme is concerned. It's so different, not only in keeping the same sound. He could perfectly well have written a line to the third line ending in go, which would tie back to the first stanza and make
give us a cyclical,
much
enough.
More symmetrical
mm-hmm.
product, as far as my perception is, but also he could just as well have said two different things in the last two lines, too. He didn't run out of things to say and just repeat it because it would fit and he had to have four.
Yeah.
Actually, the joking impish Frost once did make exactly that claim. Of course, no one takes him seriously.
Yeah.
Why do you repeat the last line? Well, I finally, my own scheme and agenda, I couldn't keep up and I just had to. I ran out of words rhyming with sweet. At any rate, I think your point's well taken. I think your point's well taken.
Could be a kind of weariness of a tired person, too. You know, you kind of say, oh, I'm tired, and you say, not at all tired, and you say it twice.
A sigh.
Yeah, double sigh.
That was the reading of the either Roxy or the woman next door. I can't remember. It's got being tired. What was your name? I'm sorry.
Laura.
That was Laura's reading, too, was the repetition. Seemed to be a kind of connote fatigue. Okay. All right. Let's suppose for a moment that this is a life and death kind of issue, growing out of the direct dramatic situation of a person lost in contemplation and feeling awkward about it, and that the awkwardness gains in intensity precisely because it grows from poetic entrancement to life over death, to the seduction of death, lovely, dark, and deep. Let's suppose that's true, and then see whether or not some of the details that we've passed over in poem take on an added significance and support that notion. For instance, can someone tell me what day of the year it is?
21st.
The 21st of December. How do you know that?
The darkest evening of the year.
Okay, darkest evening of the year, and it's what time of day?
Evening night.
Okay.
Probably
about
4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Well, we've got dusk, 4 o'clock, noon.
That would be the same then. Well, it depends on where you are in the glow.
So if it were snowy night and we're really into the night, you couldn't see anything.
It could be better.
It's an evening, stopping by woods in a snowy evening.
It can be even brighter.
Okay? So in terms of the cycle of day, from dawn through noon through afternoon, it's evening. It's the last cycle of the day. It's the last cycle of the season, winter. And not only that, it's the darkest evening of the last cycle. Remember when we read the
for those of us who were here and who wrote Not Taken, we found a kind of interesting discrepancy, since Frost was constantly making us make choices in our reading of the poem. We found that it was a yellow wood, which was autumnal, but it was a morning. So we found that in terms of the daily cycle, it was morning, and in terms of the annual cycle, it was yellow wood fall. So there was a kind of tension between that. If we wanted to get at the significance of the moment, we couldn't say, well, early morning, the beginning, because there was the autumn thing. Here, the day cycle and the annual cycle not only coincide, but coincide on the darkest evening of the year. So, I mean, we're at a very, very profound moment in time here. Okay? All of the ways we measure time temporally coincide here to be at the darkest evening of the year.